On this episode of the New York Baseball Podcast, me and Wally, we sit down with the radio voice of the New York Mets, Mr. Howie Rose.
And wait till you hear him tell the story about his parking lot confrontation with John Sterling.
You don't want to miss that. We also talked a lot about the New York Rangers, too, and, of course, the New York Mets. As for the Yankees, their pitching is starting to crumble a little here, Wally. It's starting to show a little bit of a slowdown process here.
Yeah, it is. But, I mean, what's worse than taking your supposedly best hitter, the reigning National League MVP, and sitting him down against a pitcher that the rest of your team can't hit?
That's Justin Verlander. He's now becoming the new Curt Schilling. All that and more coming up next on the New York Baseball Podcast. We're back for another edition of New York, Dan Canobio with the esteemed, the legendary, the immortal, Wally Matthews.
The old.
a little older than me, we'll just say that.
Okay.
Here we go. We're going to talk a little Yankees and Mets. It was a very busy week for both ball clubs. In addition to that, we have a very special guest coming on the podcast today. It was a really very long and great interview with Howie Rose.
Yeah, I mean, and some of the things that he tells you about it, you're just not going to believe. I mean, we run the gamut from Mets to Yankees, John Sterling, and, of course, New York Rangers. So a lot of good stuff to talk about with
him. Yeah, the end, when we talked about the 94 Rangers, you can just hear it in his voice how much that Howie just loves the Rangers. And it was cool because, you know, you forget that these broadcasters are fans, and they don't want to admit it. Some don't want to admit it, but Howie had no problem admitting the fact that he was a huge Ranger fan growing up and being part of that 94 Cup run and all that, in addition to just being on the call for the Mets and the in and outs. What do you do during a rain delay? Because the Mets were in a very long rain delay yesterday.
Oh, man. And yeah, I mean, Howie, let's not forget, you know, worked a 12-hour day yesterday. What was the first game? Was at 1 o'clock.
Correct.
Right? Then the second game scheduled for 7 didn't start till 10 o'clock night, ended about 1:30 in the morning. Mets held on to win at 8-5, so they split the doubleheader. But I mean, that was just an awful day for everybody concerned.
Yeah, so we'll get to Howie Rose, but let's talk a little about the New York Yankees, because they're a team that's a little struggling a little bit, Wally. 5-5 in their last 10. They had a little rough road trip in Texas, got roughed up a bit. CeCe gets hit hard. The bullpen is starting to show some fatigue and starting to show that they're not the bullpen that we saw in October. And, you know, a lot of the conversation after the loss yesterday, we're taping this on Tuesday, the loss on Monday to the Astros, that the Yankees have to go out and get more pitching. That's the biggest takeaway from the last week in my eyes.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I wrote about it after the game on Saturday when Sonny Gray, again, didn't pitch well against the Angels.
Bad Sonny.
You know, we're talking about, and it's tough, and actually this was my lead to the story that I wrote for the New York Times, is, you know, it's tough to find fault with a team that's 32-16, leading the league in home runs, you know, among the league leaders in runs scored and slugging percentage, you know, and has a pitcher who's a Cy Young candidate. In a world without Justin Verlander, I think you would be talking about Luis Severino as a possible Cy Young candidate. But if you're going to find fault, it's like after Severino and Tanaka, there really isn't much there in the starting rotation.
Right, because CeCe gets hit hard, and he's 38 years old. You don't know what you're going to get with him. Domingo Germán is starting to show some of the shine is coming off him.
Well, yeah, he had a great first outing, but, you know, after a while, it's a game and a league of adjustments. They have adjusted to him. He has not yet adjusted back. He pitched a little bit better. Pitched a little bit better the other day, yesterday, I guess.
Germán, you're talking?
Yes.
Yeah, give up the three-run home run, and then you kind of settle in a little bit.
Yeah, but you give up the three-run home run when you're pitching against Verlander, you may as well just, you know, fold up the bats at that point.
And it's like
put
Verlander,
everything in the bags and let's go home.
Yeah, Verlander is now is the new Curt Schilling. He's not as demonstrative, and he's not as much of an antagonist.
He's not as much of a jerk.
He's not. Yeah, I know you don't like Curt Schilling. I brought up a bad name there.
That's okay.
I'm very sorry.
It's all right, you woke me up.
Wally wants to beat the crap out of Curt Schilling.
I guarantee I would.
I would love to see that, actually.
No, so would I.
Can we set that up?
I've tried, but he went on a radio station and said, "Oh, this guy's a nobody. I'm not going to fight him." Yeah, because you get your ass kicked and you know it.
Can we lure him to the
Wiffle Ball
tournament?
Oh, no, I don't think so.
I know he's got he's got lost a lot of money with his video game company.
Good, I hope he loses it all. Let's move on. Let's move on.
But the reason I brought up Curt Schilling is because, like, he was the big antagonist for the Yankees in the early 2000s, and now it's Verlander. They can't beat him in the playoffs. They can't beat him in the regular season. He tips his cap to the fans yesterday. Did you see that? They were booing
him. No, I didn't. I was actually at a barbecue.
They were booing him like crazy coming out of the game, and he tipped his cap. He took his hat off, and he tipped it to him because that's a Bronx cheer.
Yeah, it's a sign of respect.
Yeah,
right?
So
from both ways.
And you take a look at this team, and like you said, they're 32-16, whatever their record is, and their offense is not a problem. Like, they're scoring 6.5 runs a game. But the problem is the pitching, and this is a big reason why when they got Giancarlo Stanton, I was not excited. The only thing I was excited about is that the Yankees were back to being the Yankees and being the big bad team and a lot more hype now, and they were going to get a lot of more attention. But I didn't think that they needed them. I thought they needed more pitching. I thought they needed more timely hitting, because the reason they lost last year to the Astros is because they got outpitched.
Yeah, and the problem here is, and by the way, you know, they got a game tonight with the Astros, and I'll be at that one, and then tomorrow they get Dallas Keuchel, who's not having a great season, but always handled
He's
them
a Yankee
pretty
killer.
Well. Absolutely. Tonight, Charlie Morton, who's also been, you know, very, very good. The thing about the Yankees pitching is not so much that the five guys they have, or at least three of the five, are not that reliable. There's nobody down on the farm ready to come up, you know? I mean, Justice Sheffield, how many starts has he had in AAA?
I'm glad you brought that up, because Justice Sheffield, he just made his fourth start at AAA yesterday.
Yeah, so
he's 22 years old.
I mean, look, and it's possible. Look, if you're really good, you're going to excel at every level.
Right.
Every time you take a step up, you're going to do it. But do you really want to thrust that kid into, you know, the kind of games that he's going to have to pitch in?
Well, the one thing is that it was 2015, the Yankees did this with Severino, who was probably on the same level as Justice Sheffield in terms of being a prospect. I think he was 22 years old, just like Sheffield was. But they didn't bring up Severino in May. They brought him up in August. So they gave him 10
and
to 12 starts.
Terrific.
Yeah, they gave him 10 to 12 starts. So I think that if they do go to the farm and they do bring up Sheffield, it's not going to be anytime soon. It's going to be in August. They're most likely going to make a trade. And we saw Cole Hamels pitch on against the Yankees, and he pitched very good. He's a name that they're throwing out there. I know Jay Happ is a name they're throwing out there. So maybe when you cover the Yankees in the upcoming days, you can kind of maybe feel around to see, you know, who's out there.
Well, the thing is, you see, here's the thing. Between now and the trading deadline, a lot of things are going to change. Some teams who are out of it right now are going to be in it and not going to want to part with pitching. Some teams that are in it right now might drop out of it. You know what I'm saying? You know, who knows? What if the Astros lose 30 games in a row? Right?
Yeah.
What if they do? And they say, you know what? Let's get rid of Verlander.
Exactly.
We
don't know.
You know, anything can happen.
No one knew that Verlander was going to be available.
Exactly. So you don't really know what's going to happen. But the good news for the Yankees is they do have parts they can trade. I mean, you know, I know the fans love Clint Frazier, and they can't wait for him to be brought up, and they think they're never going to see Aaron Hicks again. But he's a pretty valuable trading piece.
Who's that? I'm sorry, I missed it.
Clint Frazier.
Clint Frazier, yes, of course.
So is Brandon Drury.
He had four hits yesterday, Clint Frazier, down on the farm.
But it's wonderful. His trade value goes way up.
Yeah.
Brandon Drury's a good piece.
They have a ton of pieces, believe me. They
Absolutely.
Have a ton of prospects. They're in a great shape to make a move. It's just like, who are they going to get?
Well, the thing is, nobody makes a move until July 31st.
Right.
You know, so that's the thing. You know, if anybody expects that they're going to trade for a pitcher tomorrow or next week, it ain't happening, because right now the second wild card makes almost everybody think they're still in it.
Yeah, that's the thing, that the deadline now gets moved back. Like, Verlander got traded last year. It was the waiver deadline because of so many teams were still in it. But on a somber note, while you were there on Friday night and when you got Saturday when you got the news that Ronald Torres.
Ronald Toe was sent down.
I missed him already.
This has got to stop. This has got
no,
to stop.
I mean, they're what are they, 1-2 since they got rid of him? This is
the curse of Toe. Yes. All right. You know, the funny thing is, you know, look, I like Torres. Everybody likes him. You know, you look at the guy and you know that there was probably a dozen times in his career where he showed up at the clubhouse entrance and the guys wouldn't let him in. Like, what, are you kidding? You're a player? Get out of here, man.
Get out of here.
He's a little dude. You know, he really is. You would not, you know, you wouldn't look twice at him on the street, but they act like he was Lou Gehrig, for Christ's sake.
He's a glue guy.
Come on,
your boy,
stop it.
Brandon Cuddy.
And then you get Aaron Boone saying, boy, you know, when I broke the news, it was a rough night in that room. As if like there was a group weep fest.
They probably love him.
You know, like they had to mop up the tears off the floor. I'm sure they like him a lot. But believe me, if things don't go the way they wanted to this year, it will not be because Ronald Torres is not there.
No, I think so. I think it's all going to be because of Ronald Torres. But I heard they kept his locker, though.
Well, they,
like,
you know what?
Shrine.
I'm going to see. I wasn't there yesterday, but we'll see tonight. But, you know, for 2 days, his stuff was still hanging there as if he left it, and, you know, he just went home for the day and he's coming back. So, yeah, it does look like a shrine, and I do think they're going to stencil his number somewhere in the infield, you know, for safekeeping. Now, he'll be back. He's a useful player, but for God's sake.
Yeah, they had to send him down.
Here's a bigger story, okay? Here's a bigger story.
What do you got for me?
You're playing against Justin Verlander, a guy that you can hit yesterday, and the NL MVP of last year is on the bench.
What is up with that?
I don't know.
I know that Boone said that he just wanted to give him a good time to give him a breather.
You're facing a pitcher you can't hit.
He was 0-for-12 in the series before that with 7 strikeouts. He sucks against right-handed pitching.
He's terrible in Yankee Stadium.
He's bad against right-handed pitching. Oh, well, maybe that's why he wanted to sit him against Verlander.
But didn't he's still send a dangerous message. Bat.
Didn't send a good message, and it was, just wasn't, you know, just didn't look good. The fact that, you know, our $20, $30 million man, the MVP, is sitting against the team that knocked you out of the playoffs last year.
Yeah, I mean, the point is, if he's not in this game, then why do you have him? Have him for games like this, right?
And then tonight he's going to have to play against Morton, and he's going to have to – obviously he'll play against Keuchel because he does hit well against left-handers. But it all comes down to beating the Astros. Yes, you want to beat the Red Sox out in the AL East, but you got to figure that in order to get to the World Series, all roads are going to lead through the Astros, a team that the Yankees had some success with earlier in the season, but we know that was just maybe an aberration. It comes down to the pitching. The Astros' pitching is so good compared to what the Yankees are trotting out there.
Well, and they can hit a little bit too, you know. Let's not discount that. I mean, they're a complete team.
What are they, Altuve have 10 hits in a row over the weekend?
Talk about a little guy who, you know, the difference between him and Torres is that, you know, he could use Torres as a toothpick. I mean, he uses him as dental floss.
Yeah, I'm
still
amazed.
Altuve is a powerfully built small guy.
I'm still amazed by Altuve on a daily basis. But, you know, the Yankees, they have their work cut out for them when it comes to the Astros. They're going to beat up on the bad teams and the bad bullpens. But, you know, it's a good test for this team to see how they fare against the better teams in the AL. Astros are one of them.
Absolutely. This is absolutely a yardstick series because this, as you're right, you know, you're right. If you're going to get to the World Series, you're probably going to have to beat the Astros, or you're going to have to hope somebody else knocks them off.
It could be the Red Sox.
Could be, but I mean, you know, at this point, until proven otherwise, Houston's the class of the AL.
Yes, they are, and the Yankees will have to get through them. But we also have Howie Rose on the podcast, and this is a very wonderful interview, a thorough interview about the Mets. We go into the Rangers. We get into a great John Sterling story involving him and a locomotive. Or not a locomotive, an automobile.
An automobile, a very, very surprising automobile for John Sterling, because I kind of see him as like, you know, like a Cadillac type. Wait till you find out what John Sterling was driving.
Let's get to
Howie Rose ran into him.
Here's Howie Rose on the New York Baseball Podcast.
You know, Dan, like a lot of people, I was at a Memorial Day barbecue yesterday, so I was only kind of following the games on my phone, you know, to see what was going on. And I saw, you know, both the Mets and the Yankees had lost the first game. And then as the day went on, I kind of forgot that the Mets were playing a doubleheader, you know, a couple of drinks here and there, hanging out. So I get home around 10 o'clock. I figured, oh, geez, I better find out what the Mets did in the second game. And I go on the MLB app, and I find out they haven't even started yet.
Jeez.
So if there was ever an award given for, you know, a broadcaster going above and beyond the call of duty, our guest this week would certainly deserve it. A man who sat through, I guess, 6, 9 hours or 10 hours in the ballpark, only 6 of which or so were actual baseball. The voice of the New York Mets on radio, Mr. Howie Rose, joins us today. Howie, thanks so much for coming on, especially after that ordeal last night.
My pleasure, guys. Good to be with you.
So, I mean, let me give you a moment to vent if you feel like it. I mean, here it is. It's Memorial Day in Atlanta. You get through the first game. Why the heck wasn't this a single admission doubleheader?
Well, you'd have to talk to the Braves about that. But most teams prefer to try to do 2 separate gates.
Sure.
For obvious financial reasons.
Right.
And they can't project the weather 3 weeks or a month in advance when a game is rained out, how it's going to be when they make it up. But look, I know that as a guy who remembers going to straight doubleheaders as a kid, they were a lot of fun. I don't know that there's a clamoring for traditional doubleheaders anymore because of the length of the games as they are today, but I'll always vote for the straight doubleheader rather than the split.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I remember the old Twi-Night doubleheader. That was actually my favorite. I guess the first game would start like 5 o'clock or so, and you'd still get out of there before 10 o'clock at night. It's crazy.
Back in the day when they played 2.5-hour games.
Yeah. So, all right. Now, in all honesty, Howie, I bailed on the game at about 12:45 when the Mets took the lead, even knowing that the bullpen could still blow it. How, you know, first of all, what were you thinking at that point? You know, you're 3 hours into the second game, which, of course, you know, went like almost 3.5 hours. How do you keep your enthusiasm? How do you keep your interest at that point at the end of a really long day?
You know, you have to sort of, and this is just how it works for me. You need to let down whatever sort of guards that you occasionally put up as a broadcaster and allow yourself to get a little punchy. And trust me, we were punchy for the last hour or so. And believe it or not, that's what really helps you get through it, because you just feel loose. It's like you've, you know, unbuttoned your collar, loosened your tie, which I don't wear to a game, by the way. I'm just creating a bit of a metaphor. But if you can find that sort of sweet spot between being goofy and responsible, then it makes the time pass a little bit further and more enjoyably.
You know, figure the fans are a little punchy. The fans at home are punchy. It's 10 o'clock on a Monday night. So, yeah, why not have a little fun in the booth?
Oh, we're only too happy to accommodate them at that point.
Now, you know, one thing that people always ask me, you know, as a reporter is like, you know, what do you guys do during rain delays? And basically I stare off into space or tweet or, you know, do whatever just to pass the time. But, I mean, this was an inordinately long delay. What exactly did you guys do, you and Josh and Rustin, do during the rain delay?
Well, personally, I thought it was somewhat fortuitous that last night was the first game of the Stanley Cup final. So I'm pretty well glued to that until the Mets resumed play. And that was a great escape. Nowadays, when you have your computer, or your iPad, or whatever, you know, you use to scour the internet, that becomes a pretty good escape. Steve Gelbs and Wayne Randazzo play around on Instagram during rain delays, and I went on to a live thing with them, and we had some laughs with that. So there are ways to enjoy the time, even if it does become tedious.
Now, Howie, I watched that rain delay theater on Instagram. I was one of the 150 that tuned in. And it was very, very entertaining. I was thoroughly entertained, and I had some takeaways from it. And one of them is that they brought up the Twitter, and if you're on Twitter, and you said that you're a lurker, you're a guy that's that,
oh, absolutely, you're a major guy that, lurker.
So what's it going to take to get you on Twitter? We saw one of your colleagues, Keith Hernandez, get on Twitter, and look at him. He's now a superstar on the forum. You ever thought about, you know, firing off a tweet?
Maybe I need to get a cat.
Right. That's good. You always
first
tweet through an animal. That's always safe.
Right. Apparently, that's it.
Yeah.
But you, now, you know what it is? And I said this on the Instagram thing last night, too. As you guys know, you need to be on Twitter for information purposes. And professionally, we need to know what's going on elsewhere. And Twitter allows us to do that. But I just know myself, you know. And I might be thinking while I'm having dinner, oh, I got something cute, or I've got something funny to say. And then you take that next sip of wine and you say, okay, I'm going to hit it. And then it's like a pitcher who grooves one down the middle, and before it even reaches the plate, you wish you could grab it back.
Oh,
yeah. You wish you could grab it back. That's, I know it would not end well.
And you're absolutely right. Drunk tweeting is very, very dangerous for your career. And second of all, it doesn't matter how quickly you take it down. Somebody saw it and somebody grabbed it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What about your daughter now is Alyssa Rose. She's now a social media correspondent for the Mets. Does she try to get you on Twitter? Maybe she can give you like a tutorial.
She has been trying to get me on Twitter for as long as Twitter's been in existence. She knows my handle. She is sworn to secrecy, and she understands my reticence, and there have been times I've seen her tweets that I've gone, wait a minute, you can't say that. You know, you don't want to present that. But she's got a little different perspective than I do, and she's tamed it down quite a bit over the last little while. So I'm proud of her, frankly. She's doing a great job with it.
Yeah, you should be, but I will tell you this, Howie. As a guy who has gotten in trouble on Twitter and even was suspended for a couple of days a few years ago, because I did something stupid.
Hold on a minute. Who suspended you, Twitter or an employer?
Can I take the fifth on that?
Oh, okay.
An employer.
No, exactly it was an employer.
It was an employer.
Yeah, well,
exactly
Twitter doesn't
suspend
people. We know that.
But I get it.
Yeah, so it's probably smart just to lurk because you get a lot of entertainment that way and you stay out of trouble. Anyway, let's talk about the Mets and what's going on here. I mean, you know, I covered a lot of the early games when they ran off 11-1, and you know, as a longtime Met fan, I'm a Met fan almost as long as you are, I had a sense of fatalism that this was way too good to be true. What were you thinking at that point?
Well, I've always subscribed to the axiom that you're never quite as good as you look when you're winning frequently, and or rarely anyway. You know, in '86 they won 108 games, and it seemed like every 2 weeks they were 11-1. But you're also never quite as bad as when you're playing as poorly as the Mets have at times over the last few weeks. So I still think they're somewhere in between. But I feel like we say this every year, but we're back to the same refrain. They've got to get healthy, and they've got to get their run producers, Cespedes and Frazier in particular, back, and that'll give the whole lineup and the run scoring thing a bit different look than it has now. And they've got some things they need to straighten out with the rotation and the bullpen, but you know, I still think they've got a chance to be a pretty good team.
Yeah, the one thing, Howie, I would say, though, is that the health issue is obviously connected to the age of the roster. And, you know, you look at the Braves and, you know, how they've rebuilt, and they have a lot of young guys. The Mets seem to have a pretty narrow window here. I mean, when you look at guys like Cabrera, like Cespedes, like Frazier, Jose Reyes still starting games. I mean, you know, these are not young guys. Jay Bruce.
No, without question, they sort of threw a lot of eggs into that relatively aged basket, hoping that they can keep them on the field and stay productive pretty close to what their average years have been, and then hope that the pitching would stay healthy and carry them. That's been a wildly inconsistent graph so far this year, and it really just brings us back to the same concerns or questions that we might have had during spring training about who they are. If, and it always comes down to, you know, Rudyard Kipling's the most popular guy in sports, but if they can get those guys back and straighten the pitching out to where, okay, you've got two studs at the top of the rotation, and you've got to be better than essentially three-fifth starters, which is what they've had so far. Matt has put a couple of better ones together, a Wheeler too. So that's promising, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Now, Howie, you talk about the older guys on this team, and there's one young player on this roster that's shown a lot of promise. That's Brandon Nimmo. And now we saw a little bit of Bruce playing first, and Cespedes out, so it's given Nimmo more chances here. But when all these healthy parts come back, how does Brandon Nimmo get into that lineup? Because I really think that you know, he's a big factor going down the stretch.
The way I've always felt it would evolve, and this goes back to the earliest stretch that Nimmo had when he started to show that he was going to be a big league player, was that ultimately Jay Bruce would play a lot of first base, and Nimmo, Conforto, and Cespedes would be your outfield. Adrian Gonzalez is somewhat surprisingly hung around to a productive level at this. You know, we're almost 2 months into the season now. In fact, tomorrow I think it's exactly 2 months.
Wow.
And I know a lot of us, and myself personally, I felt by Memorial Day Adrian Gonzalez might be an ex-Met.
Right.
But he's shown enough to warrant playing time that kind of complicates that equation.
You know, Howie, I'm going to contradict what I said about aging just a minute ago and say I'm not upset with the Jose Bautista acquisition. I think it's a low-risk, possibly high-reward thing. I mean, you know, obviously he hasn't done all that much yet, but what do you think of that?
Well, it's just depth. You know, he's not going to play every day, and if, in fact, he can play serviceably at third base, in addition to what he can do in the outfield, it just maximizes the chances that you have to use him and get something out of him. But he is what he is. You know, he's a bench player right now who's experienced and has an opportunity based on knowing some of the pitchers, not really in the National League as much because he hasn't been here. But just, you know, having a feel for what it takes for a veteran player to keep himself serviceable, yeah, it's not going to hurt.
All right, so now we've seen about 2 months of Mickey Callaway. And listen, he came in here with a reputation to be a great handler of pitching. So far, there's been one or two questions about some bullpen usage. Now, do you put that down to just inexperience with in-game managing, or are you more inclined to look at the pitchers themselves and say, hey, these guys aren't getting the job done?
You know what? I almost always look at the players and say that, assuming they're placed in a position where they have a reasonable chance to succeed, in other words, not being asked to do something that they've hardly ever done, then I think the onus falls on them. Mickey can play percentages. They have one lefty in the bullpen and Jerry Blevins. Jerry hasn't gotten left-handers out. So that kind of ties his hands a little bit. And I get the feeling that, at least for the next little while, we'll see Blevins in somewhat lower leverage situations than where he's been used recently. But, yeah, I mean, there are some situations you can look at and say he could have gone longer with this guy or perhaps been a little quicker to get this one out. But I think he's got a fine feel for it. It's just a matter of performance.
Do you feel like, you know, he's kind of second-guessing himself now? He has had a few tough stretches here where, you know, like Wally just alluded to, where he's been a little snake-bitten by some of his calls. You're with him on a daily basis. You know, you can get the temperament of him. Have you seen him starting to crack a little bit? Or is he, you know, the same as Mickey Callaway, you know, steady?
No, not crack. I think he might feel a little snake-bitten recently because of moves that made sense, theoretically, that didn't work out. But, hey, he wanted to be a manager, big boy. That's what life is about.
And in New York, no less.
Yeah, exactly. So he'll get used to that because he has no choice. He has to.
Yeah, we're talking to Howie Rose, the voice of the Mets, on radio here with Dan Canobie and Wally Matthews. Howie, I've always wanted to, you know, like when people ask me what my favorite Mets team was, I always go back to the 69 team because that's when I was a kid. I was 12 years old and it was, you know, just the greatest season I've ever watched in my life. Now, you've obviously worked a lot more Mets games than I have and you've been closer with the team. Which is your favorite Mets team of all time?
Well, as with you, 1969 was a gift from above.
Right.
And to this day, and, you know, I'm very proud to say that you know, there are a handful of guys, at least on that 69 team, that I've gotten to know pretty well over the years and would call personal friends. And I still feel a little different around them than I do anybody else because of the fact that I was 15 when they won, and it fulfilled dreams that I didn't dare dream at that point, given where the Mets were in their infancy, really. But I think most Mets fans of a certain age would agree that as great as 86 was and any of the other pennant years were, and obviously 69, my favorite year was 1984 because that's the year that they broke through. They had been bad since 77. Mm-hmm. Davey Johnson was in his first year as manager. They turned the corner. They won 90 games with a team that was pretty young and very promising, and we got a taste of what was to come in 1984. And, man, I enjoyed that year so much.
And they had a kid named Dwight Gooden who threw the baseball like, you know, nobody we had seen since Tom Seaver, I guess.
Exactly. It was so exciting to know that when you come to the ballpark, even that year, although there was so much better to come over the next couple of years, you were going to see a young pitcher, whether it was Doc or Ron Darling or Sid Fernandez. And Rick Aguilera came up in 85 and showed you that he was going to be a pretty good big league pitcher. You knew you were going to get a well-pitched game from a young guy who can be doing this for years and years and years. And then the core of that team with Doc and Darryl were potential Hall of Famers who sadly didn't live up to that. But by the same token, you knew you were in for a nice ride with that team. 84 was the beginning of it. And if I can use, and Wally, you'd remember this, some Frank Cashin verbiage here.
Okay.
I would submit to you that if he hadn't approved one of the dumbest decisions in the history of baseball administration by leaving Tom Seaver exposed in that silly compensation draft, that 1984, still a 39-year-old Tom Seaver, might well have kept them in that race against the Cubs even longer and maybe even gotten them over the top.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because I always thought that that was, you know, like done accidentally on purpose. I don't know why. I just always had the feeling like, you know, they wanted to be rid of Tom.
Oh, I don't disagree with that at all.
Yeah.
No, I totally agree with you.
Now, do you feel like 2015, you talk about a year when the Mets broke through in 84 with all the young pitching. Do you feel like 2015 had that feel for you with Harvey and Syndergaard and DeGrom and everything that happened that year, acquiring Cespedes and going on that, you know, crazy run to the World Series? Did you get sort of the same vibe with that squad?
From the pitching perspective, yeah. But as we've learned over the years, as fragile as pitchers are, and I don't know that they're any more fragile than they were a generation or two ago, they're just handled differently, and the mentality about how deep they're supposed to go into games has changed so differently. But in terms of talent, yeah, you know, we thought what we saw a few years ago was going to sustain itself largely the way that group that won a World Series in 69 and a pennant in 73 would sustain itself. But to this point, that hasn't to be. But it's not to say that it can't be, because obviously you watch DeGrom and you watch Syndergaard, and you know they're special, and we'll see what's behind them because, again, you know, Mets and Wheeler have had some reasonably encouraging performances recently. But I don't know. To me, when you look back at that core of the 80s and the 69 group, It's going to be hard to match that.
You're not kidding. But you know what? Let's talk about Harvey for a second. I mean, to me, he's one of the most – in some ways, he's a mystifying case. In other ways, it's pretty predictable. I mean, he had two very, very serious injuries. We know that. But right. Also, I got the sense, especially this season, that he never really – and I think you were sitting in the press room when I asked Mickey the question, whether he ever actually bought into the role of being a relief pitcher or the mindset of reinventing himself. I got the feeling he never really bought into that, and I didn't think that he would be able to succeed unless he did. Now, whether he's able to do that in Cincinnati remains to be seen. But, I mean, what's your opinion of what actually went wrong with Matt Harvey?
Well, you know, I think in Matt's mind, being asked to go to the bullpen would be the same as Weeb Eubank asking Joe Namath to be the backup quarterback to Mike Tolliver or Babe Parilli. You know, Joe wasn't going to handle that well, but he didn't have to because he was Joe Namath.
And he did
Matt
win
Harvey,
a Super Bowl.
I'm sorry?
And he did win a Super Bowl. I mean, Matt Harvey hadn't done that, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I think the thing with Matt is that, you know, Matt Harvey wanted to be Joe Namath, but he's turned out to be more like Bo Belinsky.
Wow.
And that's an unfortunate reality, you know.
Bo Belinsky dated some very pretty girls, which, you know, just
exactly.
Like that. So, but, I mean, yeah.
Ann Margaret.
That's right. That's right. Ann Margaret, I think, is the gold standard. But I think Mamie Van Doren was pretty good as well.
Right.
Now, let me just ask you this. I mean, in a way, I always got the feeling that Harvey wanted to be those guys without – and I don't want to say not putting the work in, because I don't know what – I mean, I'm told his work ethic was great, but I don't think he ever really grasped that those guys did something to become those people. You know, Jeter, Joe Namath. Obviously, he talked about how he wanted to be another Jeter. Well, there was work involved and accomplishment involved in that.
And it also means that there's got to be some time that goes on where you become – venerable and successful.
Right.
And it's not just the longer you hang around, the better you're perceived. You got to put the results out there every year, the way Tom Seaver did,
right.
The way Derek Jeter did. You know, you look at Tom Seaver's career in retrospect, as long as people thought that Matt Harvey was the next Tom Seaver, it takes you 20 years to become Tom Seaver.
Sure.
Because it's very often just in retrospect that you appreciate just how incredible these guys were to be able to do what they did on an annual basis. You know, Tom Seaver pitched until he was 42 years old.
Yep.
It was really only at the end when he had knee problems that the injuries got to him.
Mm-hmm.
He had sciatica one year and was a 500 pitcher in 1974, but he won the Cy Young Award the next year. You know, nowadays, you know, if a guy wins 11 games, you're ready to send him to Cooperstown.
Well, that's absolutely right. You know, longevity obviously is a big part of greatness, but do you consider, and I've thought about this, in a way, the Mets kind of rushed it as well. I mean, you know, Harvey had a good year or two, and suddenly, you know, they were promoting Harvey Day, and it was they kind of like put him on
a
pedestal before he had actually gotten there.
Well, I don't know that any one party is more responsible than the other for
right.
pushing that narrative, because now on the day of social media, everybody latches on to it,
yeah.
and everybody wants to sort of perpetuate this image that someone who isn't yet really is.
Yeah.
And certainly the Mets got behind it, but, you know, Jimmy Fallon got behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you're Matt Harvey and you're in your second year in the big leagues, and it's not even a full year since you pitched your first big league game. And there you are on the Tonight Show walking around New York trying to get people to talk about Matt Harvey when, you know, they're not supposed to know that you're Matt Harvey. That's a pretty good bit.
That was a good skit, though.
He wasn't even a full year into the big leagues yet.
Yeah, it's a great point, though. I mean, in a way, you know, social media accelerates everybody's learning curve here, and some guys just aren't ready for it.
So is that why you stay off of it, Howie? Is that why you stay off social media then?
You know, the only reason I really don't go forward with it, as in addition to what I explained before about my own fears about saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, is that I just don't want to deal with the haters, and I don't want to be sucked into conversations or arguments or
narratives. Welcome to my life.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Believe me, I did talk radio for a long time. Those were my Twitter days, as far as I'm concerned.
So Twitter is talk radio on steroids, because everybody gets through, unfortunately.
Howie, going back
and very often anonymously.
Yep. Oh, always. Almost always.
Going back to what you were saying about Harvey. Going back to what you were saying about Harvey and how he was kind of accelerated and, you know, kind of getting a lot of praise before he really accomplished anything. I don't say we're seeing that with Syndergaard, but, you know, you had Dave Island come out and make his comments about what has he really accomplished. And I feel like Met fans want so much more from Syndergaard. And he's pitching to, what, like a 3 ERA, and that seems like it's just not enough. And, you know, we want him to go deeper into games and start to dominate. But what did you make of those comments from Island, and what have you seen from Syndergaard, and what more can we get out of him as a pitcher?
Couple of things there. For one, I love what Dave said, not because of what he said specifically, but because of what he and Mickey Callaway represent, and that is new blood. Noah Syndergaard, Jacob deGrom, anybody really in the Mets clubhouse kind of start from scratch with this administration. There's no real equity there, given that Mickey and Dave in particular haven't been here before. So they look at what they've got, and then they adjust accordingly. And I think that lately they've been on Syndergaard's fastball. I'm not a pitching coach. I can't assess it mechanically. I don't know why. I know that Dave has talked about trying to get him to work up in the zone a little more and, you know, get more swinging strikes and go from there, but not the finished product. And I think that's really all Dave was trying to say, is that there's a lot more. And it almost goes back to what I was saying a little while ago about Seaver. It takes you 20 years to be Tom Seaver. Even in New York, as shrill and as virulent and passionate as we can be, you don't anoint somebody after a year or two. You need to look at it years down the road and say, yeah, they were every bit as good as we hoped. And I think all Dave was trying to say is, let's be patient here. This kid's pretty good now, but he's not there yet, wherever there is.
You know what, Howie, I agree with you that, you know, I agree that Dave was right in what he said and all, but how did that play with Noah?
Good question, because he's been pretty supportive of what Dave said. He has not said anything publicly or, to my knowledge, privately that would tell you that that created any kind of a rift. Mm-hmm. And Noah, you know, for all the brashness and, you know, the whole Thor thing, which I think is, you know, probably best placed on a shelf at this point, just as the Dark Knight moniker was for Matt. I think Noah gets it. I really do. I remember the incident in spring training a few years ago when David Wright and Bobby Parnell took what Noah was eating in the clubhouse when they thought he should have been out in the dugout or on the field with his teammates, dumped it in the garbage can. And Noah learned from that.
Wow.
And I think, by and large, he's been a pretty good teammate. I mean, a pretty solid citizen. The only thing I didn't like was last year when they wanted him to have the MRI. He refused it.
Right.
And you know what happened the next time out. And the point I made then and continue to make, and it's not just about Noah and it's not just about Matt, is that these guys are flesh and blood. They're not comic book characters. And if they buy too deeply into the image and the narrative of being superheroes, it's going to bite them in the butt.
Absolutely right. You know, I'm glad you brought up David Wright because you reminded me of something. When I was in the clubhouse last week during the Diamondbacks series, David was in the clubhouse, and, you know, I just saw, you know, the little tableau of him and Jose Reyes. They both dressed in the same corner of the clubhouse.
Yeah. Wow. Yep.
And I was just thinking, like, how quickly, you know, this went bad. It just didn't work out the way anybody wanted it to. Obviously, with David Wright because of injury, Jose, you know, made his moves to several other organizations, but he's certainly not the player he was. I mean, do you get the same feeling, you know, when you look at those two guys, 10 years ago, this was the future of the Mets, and now it's, you know, clearly the past.
Wally, it's very funny that you present it the way you did, because I had the exact same feeling when I walked into that clubhouse. I saw those two sitting where they were, chatting each other up. And I had an immediate flashback to the night they won the National League East in 2006 on the field, dripping with champagne, cigars in their mouths, having the time of their lives, and thinking it was probably going to endure, you know, for quite a while. And it didn't, for various reasons. And David is a much more sympathetic figure now than Jose Reyes is, for a couple of reasons. But, you know, Reyes gave up a lot of that equity for the reason that had him suspended for 52 games, the domestic violence incident. And I think fans are probably, as much as at one time they adored Reyes, much, much less patient and forgiving of him now because they know what happened, or at least to some extent, what happened the night that got him suspended. So, you know, that really, that chewed up a lot of the sympathies that people had for him, and understandably so. With David, it's completely different.
Sure. Now, but no doubt, you know, there is a lesson in that corner of the clubhouse for guys like Matt Harvey. You know, obviously he didn't see it, but that, and for guys like Syndergaard, just look over at them, you know, because if you think you got it made, you know, these guys had it made in 2006.
You better believe it. And that time becomes fleeting. If, you know, if little things happen to derail that train, and they can, all of a sudden you're looking back, and that seems like a distant, cloudy memory.
Yeah.
Now, Howie, last week we had Ken Singleton on the podcast, and obviously his broadcasting career, he's announced his retirement. We got some thoughts from him about some of his favorites on the road, so I'm going to ask you a little bit here. What's your favorite city on the road outside of New York?
Anyone but the city I'm in right now.
is Atlanta just cursed?
With you.
Is Atlanta just cursed?
Oh, my.
Well, the weather is awful.
There's really no redeeming value to me of Atlanta. First of all, it's outgrown its infrastructure. You can't get around.
Mm.
The way it's built, it's hard enough just crossing the street with some of the zigzag patterns they have.
Right.
The weather here between May and Labor Day stinks. It's amazing to me they didn't put a roof on this place like they did in both Florida locales, because it's the same climate, really. I don't like Denver, but that's more because I'm just very susceptible to the altitude problems there and what they can do to you. I just feel like garbage for 3 or 4 days when I'm there,
right.
So I don't enjoy going there. But I'll tell you what, we just came from one of the most underrated cities in professional sports to me, Milwaukee.
Oh, I
love Milwaukee.
Yes.
Love it.
Yep. How many brats did you have?
A couple. without the bun.
And we made a trip there with the Yankees a couple of years ago, and I thought it was a great city, really. Good restaurant city.
The only thing that's disappointing about Milwaukee now is that, and I don't know, Wally, did you ever get to County Stadium, which preceded
Park? No, I'd never been to Milwaukee before.
Well, County Stadium had great brats. The ones at Miller Park are not as good, but I finally figured out why. Because the grill at County Stadium was the same grill that they had used since the place opened in 1953.
Wow.
So they had nearly a half century of grease baked into those brats. And that's what made them special. This stuff is a little too sanitary for me.
Well, yeah, you got to get it greasy with that.
Yeah, Chicago. Look, Chicago's a great town. You could walk blindfolded into any restaurant in Chicago and get a great meal.
Yep.
Midwestern people are so warm and friendly. So, you know, you go to Milwaukee, you go to Chicago, you go to Kansas City. St. Louis is a different story. I don't know what's happened to that town. But,
really?
But downtown St. Louis has become a mess.
Oh, really?
You got to love San Francisco.
I love Southern California. There are a lot of good ones.
Yeah.
How about the best broadcast booth from, you know, aesthetically and vision and all that stuff?
You're not going to believe this one, but my favorites are the places you hear least talked about. I love Houston's. I love Cincinnati's.
Mm.
I love Miami's. Miami's visiting radio booth is like an apartment.
Wow.
I feel like hanging up pictures and, you know, bringing a refrigerator in there and doing a little decorating.
Huh.
Because, you know, it really feels kind of like homey. You know, you get into some of the bigger markets where space is more limited because they have more national telecasts and then broadcasts going in and out of there, and the booths become a little smaller. But some of those other places I mentioned, they're great.
I heard horrors about the Washington Nationals booth. We talked about this with Singleton
last
year.
High up.
How
yeah.
it's like you feel like Singleton said he could have called a national game and an Orioles game. That's how high up he was.
Yeah, you know what? The best way I can describe it, and I do this every time, not as a disclaimer, but just to give people the idea of how we're watching the game. If you ever went to Shea Stadium and sat into the upper deck, which is how and where I grew up.
I loved it up there.
That's the same vantage point.
Yeah.
Wow.
I loved it up there. We go for $1.30. It's, you know, sometimes in the last
row. Wasn't that great?
Yeah. Yeah,
wasn't
I really
that
missed
great?
That.
$1.30.
Yeah.
I would go armed with a paper bag filled with salami sandwiches. If the game started at 2 o'clock, we would be there in time to buy our general admission tickets and race to the upper deck when the gates open to 12, watch batting practice, get a scorecard, and any life externally outside the ballpark ceased to exist.
Absolutely. You know, if I'm not wrong, I believe the hot dogs were only a quarter.
What?
I swear. My dad would bring...
Though. That's where the salami stand came in.
My dad would bring me and my two brothers. It'd be four of us, and he'd buy us four hot dogs for a buck. It's a different world.
Now, Howie, we also had John Sterling on the podcast, and very legendary radio voice, just like yourself. Do you guys get to talk often, and do you have any good John Sterling stories that you can share with us?
I have a dandy. Oof. I've got two.
Let's hear it.
John, as you know, is a little bit eccentric, and I love John. I've known him for well over 40 years. And when he was doing the Islanders, so this is mid to late 1970s, I was either still in college at Queens College, where I had credentials to cover the Islanders, or was very early in my career with first Sports Phone and then WHN. And I was covering an Islander game at the Coliseum on a brutally cold winter's night. And if you've been to the Nassau Coliseum, you know that when you step out of there in the dead of winter, you are in the tundra. It's like Lambeau Field at 2 o'clock in the morning, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So my friend and I, another Queens College student, Steve Taub, who worked for the newspaper there in Newsbeat, he was covering the game as well, and we were walking back to the car after the game. And as we approached our car, I don't even remember who was driving. I think it was me. There was John standing outside of his car. It was a bright purple Dodge Charger or Challenger. The only thing that was missing was the big fedora and the long fur coat.
Wow.
But there's John standing outside this car having an animated conversation with said vehicle, because the car wasn't starting. Now, my friend Steve and I, we're two pretty impressionable kids. We're anywhere from 21 to 25, something like that. And there's John, who we'd known, standing outside having a conversation with the car. I heard John say, "Well, you would pick tonight not to start." And then he waits for this perceived response. And he says, "Well, I understand it's the coldest night of the year, but that's no excuse." And my friend and I looked at each other, and we just dove into our cars and drove the heck out of there.
Wow.
We didn't know where that was going.
Have you ever discussed this with John?
Not yet.
No.
Not yet.
Wow.
But now that this is out in the open, I might or I might have to.
That's tremendous.
And the other one.
He's always on.
My other favorite Sterling story was when my kids were much younger. My daughters, at the time that we were at Shea Stadium, I'm going to guess that... because it was my younger daughter who saw this. She probably was about 9 or 10 at the time. And Mets were playing the Yankees, and game was winding down, and the Yankees were winning. And Chelsea was headed towards our broadcast booth, but she told me afterwards that she had come right behind the Yankee booth at the very end of the game, and she saw and heard John say, as he always does so emphatically, "The Yankees win." But when he said it, his body, and he must do this every time, literally shook.
Yes.
But she only saw this from behind him. She thought he was having a heart attack or a conniption. And she's running in. She comes running into the booth. "I think John's dead. I think something's wrong with John." Because she saw him shaking like a building during an earthquake.
Oh, wow.
But it was just John saying the Yankees win.
Did you tell her that he has that attack just about every night?
Yeah, I made her aware of the fact that that was not an aberration.
That's amazing.
So two generations of roses. You and your daughter both saw John Sterling just at his best.
John,
in his glory.
John bridges generations, doesn't he?
He certainly does. And doing his call.
He certainly does. Howie, we're going to let you go because this is almost as long as the game last night. But before we do, we got to bring up, probably the most memorable moment of your hockey announcing career. And, obviously it's the Matteau call. Ranger fans love that. Love you for it. How did you like calling hockey, and how did you feel about that call when you made it?
Oh, my goodness. It's such a long, long time ago, and yet I remember as though it was 5 minutes ago. And, how did I love calling hockey? I mean, that's the sport that I worked hardest at,
mm-hmm.
and what was my entry into play-by-play. And I used to bring my tape recorder to the Garden when I had season tickets in the early 70s. We were in the last row of the building, and a few games a year, I'd sit there with my tape recorder, driving everybody in front of me crazy. And then got to where the Islanders came into existence, and they were nice enough to give me credentials, and I do the same thing in the press box there. So, you know, hockey is an equal passion to baseball for me. I love everything about calling hockey. I just got to the point in my life where I couldn't do both of them full time anymore. The kids were out of the house, and it was time to, you know, have an off season. But that night of May 27th, 1994 is just an incredible, incredible night. And I'll tell you what made it so special for me above and beyond the obvious. Now, Wally, you're a few years younger than me, but I'm going to see if you remember the year, and it was 1971, when the Rangers lost the seventh game of the semifinal in Chicago.
Right.
Did that ring a bell?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So that seventh game against the Blackhawks, it was the first year I'd had season tickets for the Rangers. The Bruins of Orr and Esposito, who set all those records that year in 70-71, they were knocked out in the first round by this rookie named Ken Dryden and the Montreal Canadiens.
Yep.
The Rangers handled Montreal well all year. I thought that Game 7 against Chicago was for the Stanley Cup. They lost. I never got over that loss. Still not over that loss. 47 years later, I still have nightmares about that game. But when I went to work to do that Game 7 against the Devils, that was the same game. It was, you know, Game 7 with a chance to go to the Stanley Cup Final against a team that they should beat.
Yeah.
We all know how much more difficult it turned out to be against Vancouver.
Oh, yeah.
But what made that Matteau night so special for me was that I was doing that game that had haunted me for so long, and it wasn't like having a mulligan. It was just literally like going back in time and, you know, not only having the chance to experience the game, but in the broadcast booth at the Garden, sitting in the seat of my idol and mentor, Marv Albert.
Yeah.
That's what made it all so special.
That's amazing. You know, I was, as a Ranger fan, I was in the stands for all their playoff run in 79, where they went to the finals against the Canadians. You know, and they really looked, and there were some really amazing moments in that. And obviously the finals were very disappointing. So when I got a chance to cover the 94 playoff run, I tell everybody, when people ask me what's the best thing you ever covered, I must say it's the Stanley Cup Finals in 1994.
Oh, my God. You know what? I don't know that I've ever recovered from it, because I remember what my stomach felt like for days after it was over.
You remember?
Because as a broadcaster,
yeah.
You know, I was sort of trapped at the intersection of professionalism and fandom.
Sure.
That
That's
is
awesome.
A very, very dangerous intersection.
How about like right to the final face-off? Because it was a 2-1 game.
Yes, and if you were, you mean in the game
in 94
against Vancouver?
Yeah.
In the final?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There
I mean, that was
a second and a half to go, and any Ranger fan of any tenure could devise every conceivable way that that puck could have wound up in the net.
Absolutely.
In the second and a half.
And
because
a player,
Valerie Zelopukhin, put it there with 7.7 to go against the Devil.
Right. And a player that nobody would remember except that he won that faceoff.
Exactly.
Craig McTavish.
Again, I'll tell you one last thing about that, about Game 7 against Vancouver. Kevin Lowe was probably the most underrated, important player on that 94 team.
Mm-hmm.
And the night before, or I'm sorry, the night of Game 7 against Vancouver, I was going to broadcast the second period play-by-play and do the pre- and post-game stuff. So I'm standing in the hallway outside of the Ranger room about 2.5-3 hours before Game 7. And I need a pregame guest. And there's Kevin Lowe working on his stick outside the locker room. And I just said to him, what in the heck? I said, how is it that most of New York has their stomach in their mouths right now? And you're just working on your stick like it's Wednesday night against Vancouver or Winnipeg in January, you know? And he just looks at me with a little gleam in his eye. And says, look, he goes, this is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
He says, but I'm telling you something. And he said this to me privately and later on the air. He said, look, I heard the Matteau call, and I hear the passion in your voice, and I know how badly you want this. He says, I'm telling you right now, we're going to win this game tonight, and I want to make sure that you get into that locker room and drink from the Stanley Cup, because it's going to happen tonight, okay? Well, that's cool, right?
Yeah.
So now they win the game. We win the game, and Eric Spitz, who is a producer at WFAN, and I are on the ice as they're passing the cup around. And we're doing interviews whenever we could grab a player. And in the middle of a break, we happen to be in commercial, Kevin Lowe sees me from the opposite side of the ice. We were standing right near the Willis Reed Tunnel where the players came out, and he was on the other side, the 31st Street side. And he skated over to me, and he said to me, and I have a witness because Fitz was next to me, Kevin says, "Isn't this great?" He said, "I really wanted you to experience this, so make sure you get in there and drink from the cup."
Wow.
And it dawned on me. I just had this flashback to being that 17-year-old kid with season tickets, sitting in the blue seats with my tape recorder, living and dying with every face off the thing. This guy might have actually thought for one split second during Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final that if they won, he would be able to come over to me and invite me. I mean, that was just off the charts nuts. And it was one of the most memorable moments of my life.
That's an absolutely great story, and I don't think we can get any better than that. So at that point, I'm going to say, Howie, thanks so much for coming on and sharing so much of your career with us today, especially after that horrible night yesterday. How's the weather in Atlanta today?
It's the way it is every day.
Hot
May
and steamy.
Through, yeah.
But no rain, I hope?
September. Gray, gloomy, and foreboding.
Oh, boy. Well, I hope there's no rain delays tonight. I hope you guys get through it in a reasonable amount of time.
Bet the over.
Howie, thanks so much,
you.
Buddy. I'll see you at Citi Field soon, man.
Thank you, Howie.
All right, guys. Thanks for having me.
That was terrific.
It.
Thank you. Boy, that was great. Those Ranger stories were great.
I mean, let's turn this into a Ranger podcast, because that was amazing.
Well, we can't get any better than that, but I will say this. The Rangers, that Ranger team was really, really good guys to deal with.
That's what I've heard.
And that's because Messier, I think, the tone was set by the captain. And he was, just a super guy to deal with. And the next day, he brought the Stanley Cup to the Knicks game, because the Knicks were playing the next night. And I happened to be down in the tunnel. By the way, that Willis Reed Tunnel that he just mentioned, they used to have a street sign right at the intersection because the tunnel would run perpendicular. There would be a tunnel that led out onto the court, and then we run that ran perpendicular that went to the dressing rooms. And there was a street sign. One said Muhammad Ali. One said Joe Frazier.
Wow. Just that,
how cool is that, right? Just, you remember that, Bob? You were right? You were down there.
He's not in his head, yes. He's not in his head, yes.
Not in his head, yes.
But that just shows you the longevity and the career that Harry Rose has had. Obviously, he spent so much time with the Mets that we can talk about the 84 team. We can go back to the 70s. Not that he was covering the Mets then, but as a fan. And then he goes on to the Rangers, calling all those Rangers games, having that Matt Toe call. I mean, the guy he's done it all here in New York.
Absolutely. And on a personal note, let's just say, I mean, this guy worked a day of hell yesterday.
Yes.
All right. He was up until, the game. What fans don't really understand is that when the game ends, you don't just go home when you do this. The game ended about 1:30 in the morning.
And they have their post-game show.
They do the post-game show. Who knows what time he got to bed? And, right now it's noon in New York. So he maybe slept 4 or 5, 6 hours and got up and did this with us. And didn't just rush through it. He gave us some really good stuff.
He's a professional, and just shows you that these guys, they just drop whatever they have to do to come on the New York Baseball Podcast.
Well, let's just say it's because Howie Rose is a really good guy, and we thank him for coming on.
All right, before we say goodbye, Wiley, did you see this making some headlines over the weekend? I'm going to bring up two disgruntled former Yankees and Mets. Both have had their fair shares of run-ins with the law. Let's start with Jim Leyritz. Decided that he was going to go after Randy Levine, which is not the best idea.
No, it's usually not, because Randy fights back very hard. But Leyritz, he's stung because they didn't invite him to Old Timers Day. The thing is, I wish the Yankees would just say, look, Jim, your legal history is a problem here. What did they say? Like, he's not old enough, or he hasn't been away long enough?
Well, according to Leyritz, he responded to a fan on Twitter who said, "No Jimmy Leyritz, I'm not showing up." And it leads me to believe, did Leyritz pay that player to say that? Because
maybe he tweeted that himself.
Who goes or doesn't go to Old Timers Day to see Jim Leyritz? But he responded and said, "Yes, it's a joke already. Randy Levine and Debbie Timon have said I didn't do enough in Yankee history to be invited. How many sliders did they hit? LOL." Always got to throw the LOL in there, just in case people think you're serious.
Right. Well, by the way, he does have a good point. He hit a pretty important home run in the 96 World Series.
He hit three big home runs.
Yeah.
95, 96, and he hit one in 99, a pinch hit home run.
Obviously, the Yankees don't want him there because, look, let's not mince words. The guy had a DWI and killed somebody in a car accident.
But the thing is that he does work for the Yankees, technically. They allow him to go into the suites and mingle with players. He is on the Yankees payroll.
Well, then there's a little hypocrisy there.
But the thing is, I was was listening to Kay's show, and Kay said that for the secondary type of players at Old Timers Day, the guys who aren't like the Ron Guidry's and the Reggie Jackson's and go down the list, they have like a 3-year rotation where you come every third year.
He's out of the rotation. So
maybe he's out of the rotation.
All right. All I know is, look, the guy has always been very happy with himself, as you know. He called himself the King.
Yeah, the bat flip and the,
right.
Like the ultimate.
And
it
actually
dog.
Said the King on his bat.
Yeah,
he had it engraved.
He's a legend in his own
in
mind.
In his own mind, yeah, he is. But, you know, look, he's not a bad guy. What he did was terrible. If that's the reason why the Yankees aren't bringing him in, I wish they would just say that.
Really stupid idea to go on Twitter and attack Randy Levine.
It's just a stupid idea to attack Randy Levine at any time. I've done it.
You're not going to win.
No, you usually don't.
Because he's the president of the Yankees.
Yeah, and he usually has a good supply of F-bombs to drop on you.
But you see this, some fan responded, and Leyritz liked this tweet. He said, the only slider that Randy Levine has hit is of the cheeseburger variety.
Oh, my. That's clever.
Okay. If this guy wasn't literally in bed with ownership for decades. Yeah, it went on and on. And Leyritz is liking it. And then Leyritz comes out and says that, I didn't know I was sending, I thought I was sending a direct message, not a tweet.
Okay. Twitter ignorance. That's always a good defense.
Okay, how about this story now? This one is a little darker, and it's a little stranger and a little more bizarre. Lenny Dykstra, nails. He's back. He's back, baby.
He's back where? Back in jail?
No, he's not. He got out of jail.
That's
he
good.
Posted bail and he got out. This was charges stemming from his most recent arrest. A rambling Twitter session followed when he got into a brouhaha with an Uber driver in New Jersey.
Yes, he threatened to kill him. Didn't he threaten to shoot the guy or something?
Yes, and then he claims he didn't have a gun, but safe to say he got 0 stars for that ride.
He claims he didn't have a gun, but he threatened to blow the guy's head off or something.
Maybe he had a nail gun.
But let me just say something. Nails. When you say a thing like this, his most recent arrest, that says it all.
He's had a lot.
Yeah, his most recent. It was like he got arrested. It's just like the latest arrest.
Dykstra, 55, was charged with third-degree making of terroristic threats and drug offenses. The Uber driver told police that Dykstra put a weapon to his head and threatened to kill him.
But he didn't have a weapon.
Police did not recover any weapon. The ex-MLB was found in possession of cocaine, marijuana, and ecstasy. They call that the Triple Crown.
I knew he'd win it sooner or later.
At 3:30 in the morning. So Nails was getting down. He was partying.
And
it didn't stop him from tweeting when he got home.
Man, oh man.
And what did he tweet? You would think he would tweet an apology or maybe like, hey, I messed up. Nails will be back. No. He tweets Taylor Swift's lyrics from Shake It Off. But I keep cruising, can't stop, won't stop moving. It's like I got this music in my mind saying it's going to be all right. There it is.
I got to tell you one thing. I'm embarrassed for Lenny Dykstra that he even knows the words to a Taylor Swift song.
Listen,
that is disgraceful.
Cocaine's a hell of a drug.
Oh, God, cocaine's got LSD. I don't know what the hell he's on.
That's the Triple Crown. He had it all going through his system. But
jeez.
It's sad. I mean, it is sad. But it's, look at this mugshot.
I saw it. He actually tweeted that he thought he looked handsome in his mugshot.
Wow, that's once again the drugs are talking. But there it is. There's
just
take
inventory of those 86 Mets and where some of them wound. How a lot of them wound up.
That was one of the best books I've read.
Right.
Is The Bad Guys One by Jeff Perlman.
Yep.
It's, yeah,
terrific
him,
writer.
You had Kevin Mitchell. You had obviously
Doc
and Darryl. They were the leaders of it. You had Roger McDowell,
mm-hmm.
who was lighting people's shoes on fire.
That's harmless
compared to some of the things they've done.
That's like nothing. That's not even a misdemeanor.
And back in my old Champions Radio days, back when you used to come on my make your appearances on the show, as we had a sponsor of a guy who now owns a bunch of Hurricane Wings and Grill, one of them in Manorville, Vinny Greco. He was the Mets 86 clubhouse attendant. And
that
man,
was,
did he have some stories.
I'll bet that was an interesting clubhouse, wasn't it?
Oh, my goodness.
The clubhouse manager went to jail, for God's sake.
Yeah, Radomski?
No, well, him and all. Well, I don't think he went to jail. I think he copped the plea. But what about Charlie Samuels?
I don't know who that is.
That's the guy that was selling the like their memorabilia, selling the jerseys. Jeez. And all.
They were all getting their hands on everything, the
86
team.
That was one dirty crew.
Yeah, but he was telling me stories on the radio, like the tame ones. Like, you know, like Darryl Strawberry, at the end of the season, he gave me one of his Rolexes that was worth, like, you know, 60 grand. Instead of giving me a tip, he gave me that.
Sure, he probably had a couple of them laying around.
That Strawberry was the greatest guy in the world, and being, you know, one of those guys on the field for the 86, for the game 6, Vinny Greco, the guy I was talking to, you can actually see him in one of the photos, like, with his hands in the air at home plate when Ray Knight touched home. But then it was when he goes, why don't you come to the bar later this evening? Come to Hurricane, I'll tell you all the stories that I couldn't tell you on the radio. And my
Did
God,
you write them down?
I had to take a shower afterwards. Mostly, a lot of them were just insane. He went obviously Cone wasn't a part of the 86 team, but he spent a lot of time with David Cone, and man, those some good ones.
Yeah, yeah. David Cone had his own era of interest.
Oh God,
infamy.
We got a transition. We can go really down a dark place talking about the
80s. I'm not going down that rabbit hole with you, man.
Going down talking about the 80s, but we got to wrap up the show. Special thanks to Howie Rose for coming and talking to us after one of the longest days of his career.
Hi, I'm Howie Rose.
There it is. As for the Mets, they have a few more with Atlanta, then they're on to the Cubs, Wally. And then they're back home for the Orioles before taking on the Yankees. We talked about it last week, how this was the meaty part of their schedule, very tricky part of their schedule, and they're hovering around 500 right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think they actually fell to 500 after they lost the first game of the doubleheader on Monday, and then, you know, now they're back up a game over, but for a team that started off 11-1, you know, this is a rapid fall from grace.
And as for the Yankees, they have a few more with the Astros. They're going to have to win some games against that pitching staff before it's on to Baltimore. And then they go to Citi Field later on, and we're going to have some special stuff planned for when the Yankees and Mets play each other. But what do you got going on for the rest of the week, Wallace?
Well, I'm off to Yankee Stadium from here for the next two games of the Astros series, and then they go on the road, as you said. So when the Mets come back, I'll pick up them over the weekend.
All right, we're going to have to get another stellar guest next week. Who can we round up? I'm thinking maybe Meredith Varakovitz, maybe okay. Paulie O'Neill.
No problem. I'll see if Babe Ruth's available.
Yeah, who can you round up? Maybe Ronald Torres? He's got a lot of time on his hands now.
He'll be a little difficult unless we want to go to Scranton.
Yeah, so there it is. Another episode of New York, New York in the books. We'll be back next week.